Our speaker this morning, we have been friends for quite some time, as I aforesaid, and we had the privilege of getting acquainted about 3 days ago. And in just a little conversation with him, it made me feel and know that we were on the right road, the feeling of the Spirit, communication with one another. He is, as I understand it, he was born in New York, and he became an alcoholic in New York. He got sober in New York, and he's still sober in New York. And this is great, too. And as I understand it, he's done a lot of work in this fellowship and in the line of service. He's a member of the General Service Board in New York. Without any further comment, will you please, with an open mind and a warm heart, help me to welcome Ed S.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Ed, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Whew. I have been sitting here for 3 days waiting for this meeting, and I am absolutely delighted that it is here. And I love John introducing me as somebody, not that I was born in New York and that I got sober in New York, but that I'm still sober in New York. You opened the roundup with a speaker from New Zealand, and in many ways, New York is such an international city that I think you have somebody from the furthest corner of the globe and the strangest corner of the globe in front of you right now. This has been quite a trip. I started out a couple of weeks ago down in New Orleans at AA's 45th International. And for those of you who were there, you know that the spirit that is prevailing here this morning was prevailing there. And it's a marvelous thing. You know, we got orders at the beginning of the roundup, things we're not supposed to do. And one of the unfortunate hazards of being the last speaker at a marvelous spiritual weekend like this is you have heard all the other speakers. And little by little, somebody asked me last night, you know, are you afraid following such wonderful speakers? I said, no, it's an AA meeting, and even if you're terrible, they're going to tell you how good you were. I'm not at all worried about that, but as I listened to the speakers from all over the country, all over the world, and a 21-year-old who got sober 40 years ago, or something like that. I realized that my story was going down the pike. There are such enormous similarities. There really are. I can't thank the committee of the Atlanta Roundup enough for inviting me to the Roundup. And I know we've thanked them again and again and again. But let's give them another round of applause here this Sunday night. I know the work that goes into meetings like this because I've worked on a lot of them since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, they're the people who stay sober and get the happiest. Now, George, the chairman of the convention, at the dinner that they had for the speakers and the committee, told me that although this is only the fifth Atlanta roundup, there's a well-ground custom down here in Atlanta that the Sunday morning speaker gets to speak for 3.5 hours. Is that true, George? They're laughing. I'm going to say some things that June asked people who were sober less than a year to raise your hand last night. I thought that was wonderful. I saw that there were a lot of you here, and I'm going to say some things that you may not agree with. In fact, if you're in your first year in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't say some things that you don't agree with, there's probably something very peculiar about you. Because I've been in AA sober 15.5 years, and much like the rest of the speakers, I stand here this morning and tell you, I am not the same man, I am not the same person that was hurled through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous unwillingly by a psychiatrist in Brooklyn, New York, 15.5 years ago. I see things quite a bit differently now, thank God. And if you're new and we're saying some things that strike you as being just a little bit Pollyannish or a little bit silly, that's okay. You're in good company. June wore motorcycle jackets and chains. I didn't do that, but I had them on inside. And when I got here, I was very sullen. Sometimes I think I would have been better off if I could have gotten some of the hostility and the anger out, because I'm sure there would have been a sponsor around who would have grabbed me by the throat too. But I was the kind of person who sat in the back row, and I kept it all to myself, and I was very afraid when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I look back on it now, I don't know why, because I was 32, I wasn't that young, and I wasn't worried. Nobody was rushing up to me telling me, "You're too young, kid." You know, I looked like 110, they were saying. They were saying, you belong, you're in the right place. Nobody gave me a hard time. But I was still afraid. I was still very much afraid that you people would say, "Go away. You don't belong," and I don't know why. It was just part of my alcoholic nature, I guess. It was part of what alcohol had done to me over an 11-year period of time. And I worked all the time, and I did go to school, and I came from a loving family, and I knew who my mother and father were. I came from an Irish family. We've had three speakers who said that this week. I came from an intensely Irish family. A very, very Irish family. In New York City, they call people like me Narrowbacks, which is some sort of slang expression I've never understood for people, first-generation people born in the United States of Irish parents. And I usually tell some very funny stories about Irish drunks. I figure I can get away with it because I'm Irish. But after all these years in AA of telling those Irish stories, I'm stuck this morning for 5 minutes of my tour because my mother's in the back and she would not like it. If I dare to say anything negative about Irish Catholicism, I'll hear about it for the rest of my life. But you know, I was one of those people when I got here who did do some of that. I went to closed meetings in Manhattan, and I complained loudly and bitterly because I thought I had picked up some of the attitudes around me. And I thought that a large part of my problem had to do with my background. It had to do with this church, this restrictive, fundamentalist type church. I had to blame it on somebody, and I seemed to run into some people who were going to closed meetings, and they were wailing about killing off their mother and father psychologically and about the terrible churches they'd been brought up in. And I went along with that for a while. You know, you tend to go along with your peers. It's certainly one of the reasons I drank. And I never took any drugs, but I certainly would have if I was your age, June, and I was out there, you know, drinking and doing whatever we're doing today. I'd have done whatever the rest of the gang was doing. It's just that they didn't do it a lot back 100 years ago when I was born. But when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd go to the closed meetings in New York. And I got active right away in the group. I had no choice. I joined the Park Slope group in Brooklyn, and it was an old group with a lot of old-time sobriety. And to me, there are old-timers in AA, and they would hold it together. They're the people like Neely Daniels that you speak about here in Atlanta. We have them all over in different states and different regions, and they're the ones that have carried the torch so that AA could survive in the last 45 years to be there when I came in. And I started going. I joined this group with a lot of old-timers in the group, and right away they made me active. They must have seen that I needed this. I got into service immediately. They had me making the coffee. That's service in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was my third meeting, I got a sponsor. I didn't pick a sponsor. He picked me. I got a little guy, a little fellow with a sort of a Hitler kind of personality. And after I became sober in AA quite a while and I got much more psychoanalytical, I realized that he liked to push big people around. All his girlfriends were big, big women. He liked big ladies and he liked big men for pigeons, as we call them in New York. And he got me and he said, "You're making a coffee." He said, "You're making a coffee at the group tomorrow night." He gave me the key to the place. He must have been crazy. I wouldn't do that now. And I cursed that man so, because when you made the coffee, you had to get there at 6 o'clock and you stayed till midnight. And you had to pour all the coffee. I didn't mind making coffee, which I had never done before in my life that I could recall. That was all right, because you could do that quietly before the group got there. But I had to pour the coffee, and I had to pour it with both hands, and I was shaking, and I said, "This is the craziest organization I've ever heard of in my life." And it's been an amazing experience to me. You know, I've had many sponsors since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. How the right sponsor has walked through the door with a sign around their neck that says, I am your sponsor. I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous say, how do you get a sponsor? I don't know how you not get a sponsor. You know, they keep coming through the doors of meeting rooms. Here I am. You need a love sponsor, kid, a relationship sponsor. And somebody will come along and will give you a lot of good advice on that one because, you know, job sponsors came along, spiritual sponsors came along, middle-aged sponsors came along, you know. It's a terrible experience to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous at 32 years of age and to weigh about 170 pounds and to suddenly realize that as well as being sober, you want to go on a severe diet and be 18 again. And I am here to tell you, if you're over 30, it's not going to work. Work on one day at a time. It's much more comfortable that way. Now, what did I start out in life to be? Well, I did not start out in life to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not start out in life to be somebody who believed in God. I did not start out in life to be a recovered or a recovering alcoholic, if you prefer. I like the word drunk myself, sober drunk. I did not start out in life to be any of those things. I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be the president of the United States. I wanted to be a captain or a major in industry. I wanted to be a lot of things. But I did not want to be a drunken truck driver, which is what I ended up being. You know, that just sort of happened. You know, when I was a kid, I used to go to the movies a lot. I used to go to the movies, and the movies were very pretty when I was younger. All the leading men were handsome. All the leading ladies were gorgeous, or at least they certainly seemed that way to me. And I'd go to those movies 4 and 5 times a week. And a very good-looking guy and a very good-looking woman would get together at the beginning of the movie, and they would fall instantly in love. We've been talking about that this weekend, but they would fall instantly in love in the first 5 minutes of the movie. And they would immediately have a fight or an argument. And then they would spend the next hour and a half of that movie quibbling and fighting. And while they were fighting, they would be singing and dancing. And witty jokes would get told, you know. And at the end of the movie, somebody like Edward Everett Horton would bring them back together. in some very simple manner. And they would walk off. You know, at the end of the movie, into the happy ever after ending. Now, I was watching those movies 4 and 5 times a week, and I was going to parochial school during the day. And I want to tell you that Hollywood and parochial schools, for some strange reason, did not prepare me for the real world. It didn't work. I was waiting to get discovered, either by God with a stroke of lightning, or by a producer. You know, I saw a lot of movies when I was a kid where somebody with a very little amount of talent and somebody who couldn't dance very well would suddenly be standing there and the star would get sick and the producer would come in and say, you're it. You're going on tomorrow. You're going to be a star. You know, and this person would have been discovered. And you just knew that life was going to be absolutely wonderful for them forever and ever. And I went to see movies like The Wizard of Oz. I don't know how many times I've seen that movie. I still love it. I still watch it. And I'd see Judy and all those make-believe characters go dancing down the yellow brick road. And that's what I wanted to do in life. I wanted to go dancing down the yellow brick road. I wanted to get discovered. I wanted life to be soft, and I wanted life to be wonderful. And I did not want people to argue, and I did not want countries to go to war, and I did not want to become an alcoholic. You know? And I thought if life could only be like that, wouldn't things be wonderful? Wouldn't they be absolutely wonderful? Now, what happened to me is because of my inability to deal with reality, I got drunk one night. I drank for years. I come from a family where alcohol was served and my friends drank. I went with a drinking crowd. My crowd, if you didn't drink, they whispered about you. You know, they just kind of didn't trust you. And we all joined the army one night together. Korean War was on. There were 5 or 6 of us, and we all joined the army. We couldn't wait for the Navy, the Air Force. They wouldn't take us right away. We had to do it instantly. So we joined the army, and they put us in the infantry. And everybody else went to Germany and Hawaii and places like that. And it was the middle of the winter, and I found out I was going to Korea. And I went home to my mother. My Irish mother was in the back of the room this morning, and she says, "It happened to you." She says, "It happened to you again. Everybody else is going to nice places, and you're going where the war is." And I spent 2 years over there, and I don't remember much about it. I wasn't drunk all the time. I'm not going to stand here and tell you I drank, and I hung out with drunken people. I traveled with people who drank. In AA, we have an unwritten tradition. We say we don't call people alcoholic. You know, we only call ourselves alcoholic. So I won't tell you that everybody in my crowd was an alcoholic, but I will tell you that they believe very heavily in drunkenness as a way of life. And they are either sober, in AA, or dead today. I haven't had that trouble either, June, with my friends. You know, I'm either communicating with them in AA or they are no more. But anyway, I went into the Army, and nothing spectacular happened to me in the Army, you know? I think I had an alcoholic personality, whatever the devil that means, from the very beginning. I was a natural born drinker. I thought that was a great talent, and a natural born underachiever, you know? I went into the Army a Private E1, and I came out a PFC. Now that is anybody here can tell you that's difficult to do when there's a shooting war on. If you can just live through a war, you've got to do better than that. But I kept turning things down. I kept saying no. I kept backing off from responsibility. I kept very quiet. I didn't want anybody to hand me a job or a title or stripes or bars, because I never knew when I'd be taken drunk. I never knew when I'd suddenly want to get drunk. And I didn't have a very good image of myself, and I figured let the superior people do the leading, you know. I really didn't think that some of them were all that superior, but I didn't want the job either. And I went into the Army, and the only thing I remember about that is a little guy named Joe. I've never seen him since Korea. And Joe was also a Private E1. Now, the intriguing part about Joe was that he was then the age I am now, and he had been through World War II. See? Now, I should have known something about Joe. He was through two wars, and he lived, and he stayed a PFC. And he was not a stupid man. Now, what would happen to Joe, I found out after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, that he was what we'd call a periodic. He'd stay sober for weeks at a time, and you could get booze in Korea, right on the front lines, at least we could. And Joe would disappear off the front lines and go on a binge. He would find a bottle, and he would find a woman, and he would come back 3 or 4 days later, and he needed a shave, and he'd be shaking, and he'd be perspiring. And the thing that got me about little Joe is he would come down the trenches. We'd spent a lot of time in trench warfare type positions when I was over there, and he'd come down those trenches at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and it wasn't always, you know, a lot of artillery and a lot of noise, things going on. And Joe would come down those trenches, and it'd be very quiet. We'd be up on guard duty all night. And Joe would say, "Ed Small, where are you?" And I said, "Why is that creep coming home to me?" I knew what he was going through, even though I hadn't been on the bender with him. A couple of years later, when I was further along in the progression of my alcoholism, but at that time, I wouldn't do that because they called it desertion and you could get shot for that. And sobriety seemed more comfortable to me than getting shot at that time. Now, I just want to say something. You know, when I came in AA, the patterns change in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether we like to admit it or not. I don't think we're afraid to admit it. Things change. They used to talk a lot about the invisible line. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, they were always talking about the invisible line, and this was part of my fear of being cut off that I was talking about earlier. And they would say, don't worry about all those marvelous good years of social drinking that you had, kid, because there are so many people that achieve wonderful things even when they're drunk, you know. They get educations, they head corporations, they write marvelous books, you know, they do wonderful things. And I had some of these people in this group I joined out in Brooklyn. And they rushed up to me and said, you know, don't worry about the social drinking. Don't worry about the fun drinking. You crossed an invisible line, and it was progressive, and it was all downhill after that. And I used to go along with that, and I used to say, yeah. And they said, when do you think you crossed the invisible line? They'd ask me, and I said, I think I crossed the invisible line I became an alcoholic about 90 days ago, about 3 months ago, first meeting. Then they asked me that question again, And I'd say, well, I think I've been an alcoholic 3 years, about 3 years. You know, I became an alcoholic, a problem drinker 3 years ago. And the longer I stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more I admitted, or was able to admit to myself, that I'd been an alcoholic from the first drink, and probably before I ever picked up the first drink. And I don't hear people talking about that invisible line anymore. I don't know what happened to it. We seem to have lost it in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm very pleased about that. Because I had a lie when I got here. Make believe there was a predetermined time. Now, when I got out of the Army, after my spectacular career in the Army, I went home to my Irish Catholic family. Now, in this family, they rather enjoy it when you work. They're fond of that. They think it's a good idea. And I came home, and I remember I had very little money, and I was living with Mom and Dad and my sister, and what little money I had, I forget what I did with it. And I would go to the movies. I remember one day I went to see Gloria Swanson in Sunset Boulevard at Radio City Music Hall in the afternoon. I went out of the music hall and got drunk, and then I went to a movie in downtown Brooklyn. I went to see Betty Davis in All About Eve. And then I left there and I got drunk and I did some other funny things. And then I went home and I thought I'd had a wonderful day. And this was really what I wanted to do with my life. And this Irish family would look at me and say, when are you going to go to work? You know? And I'd say, well, I've just gotten out of the Army and there is this thing called the GI Bill of Rights. And I can go to school and I can study journalism. Well, they didn't know much about academia and they didn't know much about journalism. But they knew an awful lot about a drunken bum when they saw one. And they kept talking about working, and I felt that if I was going to live there, it would be best if I got a job. And I picked up a paper, and I saw an ad. I didn't know in the world what I would do with myself. And I saw an ad for a route salesman for a bakery. Now, I had no idea what that was either, but it said no experience needed, and down I went. And I got the job. They hired me, and the salesman, I was on the way out, and do you mind if I ask you a question? And I said, no, what is it? And he said, why does a young man like you want to spend the rest of his life getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning? And I said, well, why would I do that? And he said, well, that's what time we get up around here. And I said, but why? I just came back from Korea, and there's a war on over there, and we didn't get up that early over there. And he hired me. He hired me. And I started drinking on that bread truck right away. I hated the job. Of course, I hated everything before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, I hated that job. I hated everything about it. Everything about it. You know how some people drive by bakeries? I don't know if they do that in Atlanta, but up in New York, there are people who will drive by bakeries to smell the fresh bread being baked. I thought that was an awful smell. It made me nauseous in the morning. Never occurred to me that a quarter Canadian club might have something to do with this. I just blamed it on the aroma of the fresh bread and cake. I couldn't imagine why people like that smell. And I spent, you know, I said, well, I'll take this job. I went home and I announced to my family that I had a job, and they were rather pleased. And I said, it's only temporary, mind you. I'm going to school in the spring or some such foolish thing. And they said, fine. And 10 and a half years later, I got fired for alcoholism from this job. And I mean, it went that quick. You know, where did 10 and a half years of my life go? I would go in the morning and I would take this bread truck and I would sleep on it. And, you know, I would do everything on it. You know, everything an active alcoholic does, I would do. It's just a meeting, and I'm not going to be more graphic. I had the only bread truck in the bakery that had roaches on it. This. And nobody ever looked inside that truck. I think the management was crazier than I was. Now, let me tell you what I used to drink. I worried at a very early age, at 21, I'm absolutely convinced. At 21, I knew that I was not an alcoholic. I had other problems. I had problems to solve, and I had a career to get together, but I wasn't an alcoholic. But I knew that I was going to have a problem getting rid of empty bottles. So I started drinking on that bread truck, these little miniature bottles, these little nips. You know, they hold about an ounce and a half or 2 ounces of booze. I said, well, that's nice and neat. I said, you can just knock the cap off, drink it, and throw it away. And you won't have to worry about disposing of bottles. Now, you know what happened, right? I never threw them away. So they piled up hundreds and thousands of them all over the truck, all over this bread truck, in little brown paper bags. And when I hit a bump, as you do sometimes when you're driving a truck, the whole thing jangled, you know. It was like jingle bells. Now, the sales manager, I was very despondent at that time. That was a big word, you know, 15 and a half years ago. We call it depressed now. I was very despondent at that time because I realized I was not getting discovered on this bread truck. I was not getting to a school of journalism. I was not traveling with the jet setters. I was not writing. I was not going to become the president. I was not going to do anything but get drunk in Polish bars along the Brooklyn waterfront and continue to have this enormous problem of what to do with these hundreds of little empty bottles. My time was consumed with problems like that. There was not much time left for creativity. And the sales manager called me in one day. The sales manager of the bakery called me in one day, and he said to me, after 10 and a half years, and I was a union member, of nobody talking to me about anything that I can remember. You know, God knows we have very selective memories. But I don't remember anybody saying anything. The sales manager called me in one day, and he said, Ed, we want you to resign. And I said, I'm not going to resign. I said, I have an investment in this company. I said, it's taken me 10 and a half years to learn how to become a good bread man. He said, Ed, you're fired. I said, all right, I'll resign. Seventy-two hours later, I ended up in a psych ward. What do you do at 32 years of age when you lose your job and you don't have any money? What do? You go home to mommy and daddy, the same mommy and daddy I hear people knocking at meetings today. And what do mommy and daddy do? They do what they always did and what they always would do. They help you out. They take you in. They nurse you. They say, you'll be all right. They pay your bills for you, you know? And they didn't know anything about alcoholism. They didn't know anything about Al-Anon. They tried to taper me off and try to help me, but I fooled them. After 72 hours of staying there and being totally out of my mind, I walked into the living room of my mother and father's apartment, and they had a green and a blue wall-to-wall carpet, and in the middle of the wall of the carpet was a little Technicolor mouse. And he started talking to me. And my Hollywood education was not all for naught. I had seen The Lost Weekend, and I knew I was having DTs. One half of my mind clearly understood that there was no such thing as a Technicolor mouse, and the other half of my mind said, but there the little fellow is, talk to him. And I talked to him. And Mom said from the kitchen, who are you talking to out there? And I said, I'm talking to a friend, and he'll be back with other friends. And they came. They came. I saw them all. I heard the music and the fire engines, and I tried to climb out the window. And I got my brother-in-law, because he's a big Dutchman, to pull me in off the fire escape. He said, where are you going? I said, I'm going out. The sales manager from the bakery's out for him back. And my father, at one point, panicked because I went into a convulsion or a series of convulsions and called the New York City Police Department. And then, which really began, I thought it was the end of my life and it was the beginning. Because it was a New York City cop who took one look at me, as I recall, and said, this guy is more than just an alcoholic, let's take him in. And you see, it was New Year's Eve, some 15 and a half years ago. And the doctor on the ambulance didn't want to take me in because she said, we can't fill up the hospital with drunks on New Year's Eve in New York City. There wouldn't be enough room for all of them. And the cop got me in there, and they got me into the psych ward. And I don't know. I was very, 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 very sick and very, very dizzy. I didn't know where I was. I did say, psychiatrist. And I was ready for that guy. Because, you see, for all these years, I'd been studying the art of psychiatry in Hollywood movies. I knew all about it. They had beards. They had thick glasses. They found out what your nanny did to you when you were 2 years old. And then again, I knew all about psychiatrists. And I had been reading some books on abnormal psychology, and God, they were thick books 15 or 20 years ago. There are illnesses that were in there then that are not in there now. They vote on those things. Had I known that, I wouldn't have taken those books nearly as seriously as I did in those days. But I don't have to tell any college student who studies psychology what happens if you're just a little bit funny and you're reading abnormal psychology textbooks. You get a little crazy and you start identifying with everything in there, especially if you have a bottle of Canadian Club on the table and you're trying to find out why you're ill in the morning and why you're hungover and why you perspire all the time. And I read the books and I read the books and I finally arrived at the conclusion that I had everything in there. I identified with every illness in the abnormal psychology textbooks. I had a little bit of every one of them. I was everything but a lesbian and an alcoholic. Had I drank for another 3 years, I might have been able to work out the lesbian thing, but I wasn't that crazy. But I knew I couldn't be an alcoholic, you see, because I knew what an alcoholic was. An alcoholic was like my Uncle Joe. I had an uncle who drank once and went to Alcoholics Anonymous. They go to that place. And alcoholics, they can't shave in the morning, and they can't get into work. But most importantly, I remember when I was in my teens and 20s reading those books, alcoholics are old, see? They're in their 40s, right? Well, you all know that now. So I wasn't like Uncle Joe, not yet. So I didn't think any of that stuff applied to me. Now, I told this psychiatrist everything about myself that I had related to in those books. And he looked at me blank, and he said to me, "There's nothing wrong with you. You have to stop drinking. I want you to go to a meeting of people just like yourself who meet in this hospital tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. And they used to drink and get in all the trouble you got in. And they don't do it anymore, and they're fine. And the way they do it is they get together and talk about it and drink a lot of coffee." Now, that's not a bad description of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't remember him saying AA. I don't remember him saying that. He was a very shrewd man. I, of course, thought he was crazy. I went back to the locked ward, you know, and a young fellow that I had befriended said to me, "What did the doctor tell you?" And I said, "He told me he thinks that I drink too much and I should go to a meeting here." He said, and this young guy said to me in the, what we call the flight deck at Kings County Hospital in Brooklyn, New York. You know, and I had just spent a night in a canvas sports jacket. One should become willing to admit that the social drinking is at an end at that point. One does not resemble Noel Coward coming out of a straitjacket. He said to me, "I think you should go to that meeting," he said, "because you're an alcoholic." And I said, "How do you know I'm an alcoholic?" And I said, "What are you?" He said, "Well," he said, "I'm a heroin addict." But he said, you should go to that AA meeting. That's for you." And I said, "Well, how do you know that?" And he said, "Well, you twitch in your sleep. And you twitch like an alcoholic." And I said, and I said, "How do you know what I do in my sleep?" He said, "I watched you all last night, and I went to that meeting. I was scared to death of that guy. I figured anything's got to be better than this. This padded cell with people watching me sleep and twitch all night." And I went to the meeting, and the first guy who spoke, I don't remember anything. As so many of us in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't remember a thing about it except the feeling in the room. And you know something I've only recently recollected? You keep thinking back and thinking back. The first meeting I went to, I remember walking in. There was a big Polish fella, and that was meaningful because I had done a lot of drinking with Polish people. And I looked at him, and I said, "My God, he's normal, you know? There's nothing wrong with him. He's got two arms, two legs, a nose, two eyes. He's got a suit and a tie on." A woman spoke who was very important to me and saved me a lot of trouble. She'd only drank for a year and a half. It began when she was 68. She had been a teetotaler all her life. She started drinking at one of her grandchildren's christenings. And a year and a half later, she was hiding whiskey bottles in the clothes hamper. And it convinced me, it sold me on the disease or the illness known as alcoholism right away. Because I believed her. Thank God I believed people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was starting to have faith in people. And that was very hard won because I thought it was very clever to be cynical and very clever to criticize. I thought it was very intellectual not to believe when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I had to come to believe in AA. And it began at that meeting, but more importantly than the speakers, the room seemed to glow. The room seemed to glow. It was gorgeous. It looked like a crystal palace or something. And I went back to that meeting 6 weeks later, and it was awful. It was a disgusting room. The paint was peeling. It was filthy. There was toilet paper on the floors. It was just a dreadful place. Never hold an AA meeting in a place like that, any of you out there, please. But it looked wonderful to me that morning. And I don't remember a thing the speaker said, but I remembered the feeling. I remember the feeling. A feeling got through to me. Something in the room, a presence, what I feel here this morning. And I have felt at every AA meeting that I've gone to for 15 and a half years since then, got to me. A feeling. I felt a presence in that room. You know, all my life people had been preaching at me. All my life I had been reading books, trying to define God, to prove the existence one way or the other. All my life I've been going through these exercises that so many of us go through. And I walked into that room and suddenly all the debate was unnecessary and foolish because I felt something that couldn't be denied. Now, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. There was no way in God's green earth that you could convince me at that time that I had any sort of an illness called alcoholism. I thought I had drank too much for too long and it was now time to do penance. For the rest of my life, if need be, I would suffer and stay sober with you people. And they gave me the address of an AA meeting, and I went there, and it was in a cold January, I never had gas for the car, so I walked, cold church basement, and the coffee was lousy, and the people seemed grim, and I said, this is it. This is it. And I'm going to come here for the rest of my life. And I will do it, and I don't care if they want me to be a communist. I will do it. And I had seen trailers or coming attractions for the movie Days of Wine and Roses. Television in the shot they showed in New York of that movie showed Jack Lemmon qualifying, as I'm doing now, you know, getting up in front of everybody and bearing his soul, talking about his sins. And I was no stranger to confession. And I came to my first meeting ready to do that. Ha! Out in Brooklyn, they call it eyeball-to-eyeball AA or barefoot AA. I said to one of the old-timers, sober about 28 years in the room, when do I speak? He said, speak! Put your cotton out of your ears, stick it in your mouth, and sit down and shut up. We're not interested in what you have to say for about 90 days. You want to talk about sex or any of that filth? That's what sponsors. Not a Lonely Hearts Club, and we don't give you any money here, and all of those keep you sober if you work like hell for it. Not a bad description of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got into activity right away. Now, I've told you already I wanted to be a writer. So when I was in Alcoholics Anonymous about 10 or 11 months, I found out that we have a magazine in AA that many of you are familiar with called the Alcoholics Anonymous Grapevine. It's our international worldwide magazine, and you certainly should know about it because you're writing it. It's written by the Fellowship of AA all over the world. And I wrote them a letter. Somebody raised a question about old-timers having slips in AA, and with all the arrogance at my disposal, I wrote them a letter suggesting a solution. And they printed it. And I've been writing for the AA Grapevine ever since. And after I was writing for the Grapevine, I only lived 4 miles from the General Service office and the Grapevine office. And after I was writing for them for a while, they wrote me a letter and said, since I lived in the area, would I be interested in coming over to an editorial advisory committee meeting where they discuss the articles that are going to go in the Grapevine and get a group conscience about what goes in there. And I was terrified at the idea of going over to the Grapevine office or the General Service office of AA. I was far more terrified than an AA member in New Zealand would be, I'm sure, and I only lived 4 miles away from the place, and I declined the invitation. I was terrified to meet the people who could reject an article that I sent in. I thought it would be best if I didn't know them. They kept inviting me. I finally went. I got on the editorial board. They made me the chairman of the Grapevine Corporate Board, and eventually, after many 24 hours, I was elected as a trustee to the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous from the Grapevine. And the Grapevine has been a very, very important part of my recovery and my continuing recovery in AA, and I hope it will continue to be. Now, the reason that I bring that out, one of the main reasons is, you know, we have a new book in AA called Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. It's marvelous. You'll be seeing it in the groups in the next couple of months. They started distributing it in New Orleans for the first time. And in that book, they document why this organization works and why this organization works and why many of us stay sober here who have failed in other organizations, who have failed inside our churches, who have failed with the doctors. And it's service. It's one drunk reaching out to another. And that's all this book about Dr. Bob is, because that was the magic spark that was ignited in Akron 45 years ago when a woman named Henrietta introduced a stockbroker from New York who called up on the phone and said, I've got to talk to a drunk or I'm going to get drunk. And Henrietta said, had a phenomenal growth rate ever since. And it's very important for me to reach outside myself, because no matter how long I stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know that if I stop serving, not just attending meetings and sitting like a bump on a log, I've got to be the person at the registration desk signing people in, and I've got to be the person making up the literature rack. I've got to be putting myself into this fellowship constantly, because that service work in Alcoholics Anonymous has been the magic difference to me between becoming. It has helped me to become the type of man that I always wanted to be when I was drinking, and it always escaped me, and it always would have escaped me. And I came into an organization that was perfect for me. They don't promote you into Alcoholics Anonymous. They set an example. They really don't promote you. They coerce you a little bit every now and then. And they have little things they do. But, you know, are they coercing you? It's just so darn logical, you know. A little while back, I read some of the works of Voltaire, and he's a very clever, wonderful writer, but he's a very cynical man. And I knew what he was talking about, and I said, put that down and read the 12 and 12. You'll feel better, Ed. You know? It's more fun to feel good. It really is. And I came into an organization that paid its own bills, that supported itself, that was anonymous, that wasn't affiliated with outside organizations. I came into an organization that had leadership. Of course we have leadership in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you didn't have leadership in Alcoholics Anonymous, you wouldn't have the Atlanta Roundup. But the leaders aren't asking you to do anything that they would not do themselves, have not done themselves, and will not do themselves again. And nobody would pay any attention to it. If I walked in here this morning and told from New York for you, what do you think would happen to me? Isn't that wonderful? We even argued with Bill and Bob when they were with us. The thing that Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, it goes far beyond standing here. This is wonderful. You know, this is wonderful. I'm in communion here on Sunday morning with every one of my fellow believers in this room. I'm in total communion with you. I can see you. I can feel you. I can touch you. 50 people around me all the time. I have to be able to take the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous into my life all the time. And a very important, all our talks are based on things that are relevant to us for that 24 hours in our sobriety. A very important part of being able to live comfortably in that world is the seventh step of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want to change anything in AA. I'm one of the dyed in the wool. I've become, since I've got to change a comma in the big book, I don't want to do anything different. But if I have my way, I'd put the word humble in every one of the steps and not just the seventh step. I read it constantly. I have to read it constantly because the ego of this recovering alcoholic reinflates instantly and at the silliest provocation imaginable. Never over anything terribly important. Never over anything terribly important. Now, I want to say a couple of things here this morning, and I can talk for 30 minutes, and I cannot say them as well as two people I've already mentioned have said them. I want to talk a little bit about the importance of simplicity in this program, and I want to talk just a bit about sponsorship, and I'm going to let Dr. Bob do that for me. Because Dr. Bob Smith, co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, in his last remarks when he was very ill to us on Sunday, July 3rd, 1950, at the first International AA Convention in Cleveland, Ohio, talked to us about getting out of this program in direct proportion to the zeal and enthusiasm we exhibit, what we put into it. He said a few things. Among them, he said, there are two or three things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 set steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is, so let's bear those two things in mind. Let us also remember to guard the erring member, the tongue. If we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing, none of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to do numerous little kind and thoughtful acts in our behalf. So let us never get such a degree of smug complacency that we're not willing to extend or attempt to extend to our less fortunate brothers that help which has been so beneficial to us. Thank you very much, Dr. Bob. Now, Bill, when he was getting ready to leave us, and he knew that he was getting ready to leave us, was very concerned about the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. And even though we live one day at a time, and we don't project in Alcoholics Anonymous, by nature, after we're in the program a while, we get out of the habit of doing that. There is nothing wrong with planning for the future, and Bill was a marvelous visionary. Just read the 12 concepts, read any of the literature, and you can see that. And he was too sick to come to his anniversary dinner at the New York Intergroup annual dinner the last year, and he sent Lois, and she's been coming back every year and reading this message, and I want to repeat it because I think it's more important now, personally, than it ever has been, especially in this era of instant communications. My dear friends, recently an AA member sent me an unusual greeting, which I would like to extend to you. He told me it was an ancient Arabian salutation. Perhaps we have no Arabian groups, but it still seems a fitting expression of how I feel for each of you. It says, I salute you and thank you for your life. My thoughts are much occupied these days with gratitude to our fellowship and for the myriad blessings bestowed upon us by God's grace. If I were asked which of these blessings I felt was most responsible for our growth as a fellowship, and most vital to our continuity, I would say the concept of anonymity. Anonymity has two attributes essential to our individual and collective survival, the spiritual and the practical. On the spiritual level, anonymity demands the greatest discipline of which we are capable. On the practical level, anonymity has brought protection for the newcomer, respect and support of the world outside, and security from those of us who would use AA for sick or selfish purposes. AA must and will continue to change with the passing years. We cannot nor should we turn back the clock. However, I deeply believe that the principle of anonymity must remain our primary and enduring safeguard. As long as we accept our sobriety and our traditional spirit of anonymity, we will continue to receive God's grace. And so, once more, I salute you in that spirit, and again, I thank you for your lives. May God bless us all now and forever. Bill. I think these things are terribly important. They tie right in with what I feel about Ed's sobriety, and Ed's sobriety after he leaves this podium, and he goes back to New York, and he has to live the rest of his life one day at a time as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes I think we change very, very much in AA. You know, I go through cycles in my head of thinking that, everything is terribly different. And then I go through cycles of thinking I haven't changed very much, and a leopard doesn't change its spots very much. And sometimes I think that I'm still waiting to get discovered. And then I realize that it happened 15 years ago in a nut house in Brooklyn, New York. I've been discovered in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's all the discovering I'm going to need for the rest of my life. I'm living one day at a time from here on in. And I feel that in walking with you people and being in communion with you people and feeling the presence of God as I do in this room today, that I'm finally walking down that yellow brick road. Reality's okay. It's marvelous. I've learned in AA to love all institutions, churches, corporations, people, for their imperfections as well as their perfection. Yeah, for their imperfections as well as the things that make them perfect. I love the humanity of the people I see around me, the organizations I see around me. And I want to tell you, I want to finish by talking to the person, the people that raised their hands last night who are new, or the old-timer who's here, or the person who's here coming back from a slip, or the person who's struggling to get uphill and who's a little negative and a little cynical and is here hoping to hear something. I'm going to tell you how to do it, how to chip away at it, and get into the positive thinking that makes people so comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in AA about a year, sober, smoking nothing but regular cigarettes and drinking black coffee and trying to be very skinny and sexy looking and perfect, nearly making myself crazy. But I was trying the best I could, and that's all I had to offer. And I thought I had recalled everything there was to recall about my drinking days. And I was at a meeting, I was sober about a year, and I was at a meeting one night, and a speaker used the word bugs. I don't remember the speaker, and I don't remember the context, but the word bugs came across loud and clear. And suddenly I remembered something. In the last 2 years of my drinking, that bread truck I told you about that I used to drive around on, I noticed one day, all of a sudden, little yellow, bright, bright yellow bugs going through that truck. And I would try to catch those bugs. You know, I'd run up and down the truck after them. And this truck was not very broad, and I was. The aisle in it, I mean, it was a big truck, but the aisle, it was all bread and cake, and the aisle was very narrow. I had a lot of trouble moving around in there, especially when I was drunk all the time. I was always afraid. Alcoholics never worry about important things. They worry about nonsense. I was always afraid I was going to die on that bread truck. Now, it wasn't the dying on the bread truck that worried me so much. It was how I would look when they took me off the truck. Because I was too big to get off that truck. I thought they would have to carve me up to get me off it. And I worry a lot about that. And you Al-Anon people know we worry about those important things. And I noticed these little yellow bugs flying around the truck, and I raced up and down the aisle trying to catch them for a while, and one of them would land on the dashboard of the truck, and I'd go like that, and I'd say, got them, and I'd look under my hand, and there'd be nothing there, nothing at all. And I couldn't understand why I couldn't catch one of them. And I thought to myself, well, I said, where'd they come from? I've never seen them before. And I said, they must like the smell, this awful aroma of fresh bread and cake. I said, they're bread bugs. Little yellow bread bugs. And I accepted them. Truck was filled with them, and I could never catch them, and I accepted those yellow bread bugs as my companion, my traveling companions through life. And I never asked any of the other drivers in the bakery about those bread bugs. Once again, the brilliance of the alcoholic. I just never asked anybody, or I might have ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous 2 years before I got here. And a speaker at a meeting when I was sober a year said something about bugs. And I remembered those bugs for the first time. My story was still coming back to me. And I realized for the first time, and I was a whole year sober, an entire year sober, I realized just how sick I was. when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, when I got off alcohol, the emotional damage I had done to myself with alcohol, it took me a whole year to realize how ill I was. So if you're out there and you disagree with anything you've heard this weekend, you keep coming back. You keep listening to different speakers. You keep attending meetings. You keep following these principles. They won't fail you. And I guarantee you'll get rid of your yellow bread bugs, too. Thank you all very much. God bless you, and stay calm, everybody.